This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In his early days as Speaker of the House, Newt Gingrich exuded confidence in his ability to remake the structure of American government. He was leading the first Republican-controlled Congress in 40 years. His first book as Speaker had the assertive title, To Renew America. But in his new book, Lessons Learned the Hard Way, Gingrich confesses that he's astonished at how badly he underestimated the size and intensity of the problems that would confront him as Speaker of the House. Yesterday, I spoke with Newt Gingrich about some of the lessons he's learned and some of the challenges confronting him today. What's the main message you want to send about who you are now compared to who you were in the Contract with America era?
I don't think the message in Lessons Learned the Hard Way is primarily about me. It's about lessons I learned, but they're lessons that apply to anybody who wants to try to lead a positive governing movement in the United States. It is much harder, much more complex to be the governing majority having to actually pass legislation than it was to be the opposition minority whose job was just to stop things. And I think we really dramatically underestimated how big the difference was between being a minority and being a majority. And I would say that's the biggest single difference.
That's funny you say you want your book to teach that lesson, but every political pundit, when you became Speaker of the House, was trying to say that, you know, that Newt Gingrich is going to find himself in a really different position now as leader of the House than he did when he was the bomb thrower in the minority party.
Well, they were right, and I think it just took 2.5 years for that to sink in. I think even when we thought that we understood it, we really didn't appreciate it. It'd be a little bit like somebody who was used to driving a horse and buggy who got a 747 airplane, and even though you thought you were learning new things, it turned out that all the different dimensions, all the different complexities were far greater than we thought they were.
In your essay in the book of The Contract with America, you said, we will cooperate with anyone and we will compromise with no one. What do you think the consequences were of that no compromise position?
I think that it was probably the right direction for us to go in terms of proving that we were really committed to our values. But I think it sent a signal to Washington and to the press corps of a level of militancy that did not get covered very well. And I think that we have to recognize that to get things done in Washington, you have to compromise on details even if you refuse to compromise on principles.
In your new book, Lessons Learned the Hard Way, you have a whole chapter titled, Learn to Keep Your Mouth Shut. When would that have come in most handy for you?
Oh, I think clearly the biggest single example was the Air Force One incident, which for our listeners, when the Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin was killed in Israel, we had a sudden trip, and the President and Senator Dole and I, all three, went on Air Force One to Israel for the funeral. And we had a long time in the air together, going and coming. But none of that time was used to talk about the budget negotiations, which were then just beginning to enter their most serious phase. When I came back, I went to a Sperling breakfast, which is a political reporters group in Washington, and I talked analytically about what had happened. Why didn't we meet? What did it mean? Et cetera. And because I'm not an analyst, I'm not a historian, I'm the Speaker of the House, it got covered terribly. It sounded like I was whining and whimpering, and it was probably the worst single press I got in 3 years in terms of just something that was totally unnecessary that I didn't have to do, and that as a result weakened us for no good reason. And it was entirely because I forgot the basic rule that I never, ever am anything less than the Speaker of the House. I don't have the right to be an assistant professor of history. That's not the job I have anymore. And so reporters legitimately were covering the Speaker of the House, and then Democrats legitimately were attacking these comments by the Speaker of the House. And that was an objective reality. I was the Speaker of the House, and I couldn't get out of it.
So now that you feel you've learned the lesson, learn to keep your mouth shut, you're on a book tour. Are you trying to be very discreet during this book tour?
Well, I'm trying to apply the lesson of being disciplined. And part of what I learned was that, legitimately, if I give you a quote that is very, very hot, very exciting, very sensational, it's going to get used. And that then drowns everything else. Imagine a room that had really pretty candlelight, but then you turned on a really bright neon sign. The neon sign would drown the effect of the candlelight. And sometimes what I was doing is I was giving people very aggressive information that they could use either my body language, if I was angry, or the words I was using, or the topic I was talking about. And that, in effect, drowned out whatever I was trying to say that was positive, constructive, and problem-solving. So I think there was a real need to learn that if you're going to communicate effectively, for example, I feel very strongly that we need to use the budget surpluses to save Social Security in a way which will actually increase the retirement for baby boomers and their children by giving them a personal Social Security Plus savings account that has a tax-free buildup of interest and that allows them over time to have far more resources. If I talk about that and stay on that topic, I can probably get it covered, although it probably won't be page one. But if I then give any comment on Paula Jones or Lewinsky or Starr or all that junk, that'll drown out whatever I'm trying to say in a positive way. And I've had to really learn to focus on staying disciplined on the topic you want to talk about.
You use the word junk there, all that junk. In what way do you see the allegations about President Clinton and the investigation as being junk?
Well, it's not so much the allegations. I mean, if in fact there was perjury, obstruction of justice, and felonies, that's serious. That's the rule of law. But if you were to take the total number of hours dedicated by the networks, for example, to discussing rumors, gossip, unsubstantiated stories, leaks, counter-leaks, rumors of leaks, analysis of leaks, it's just, it's nonsense. It's a terrible way for the most powerful nation in the world to talk to itself. And, you know, I don't want to contribute to it. So I consistently tell people, wait for Judge Starr's report. Now, would you like to talk about Social Security? Would you like to talk about winning the drug war? Would you like to talk about education and learning? Would you like to talk about modernizing government so we can cut taxes? These are real, positive, serious things that affect people's lives directly. Sooner or later, Judge Starr will report. When he reports, we'll know something. And until then, let's not waste our time on theoretical analysis of the possible implications of a speculated hypothesis based on a potentially leaked but not very reliable gossip who may or may not know anything.
I'm wondering if you think that the Monica Lewinsky aspect of Kenneth Starr's investigation is sending a chill through Washington. I imagine that there are a lot of politicians who have been involved in their share of infidelities. And if at the same time that they're criticizing the president, if they're concerned about at some point a similar investigation being mounted into their own infidelities or accusations of infidelities.
But see, now you're going down the same trail. I mean, now here we are from an interesting book interview off on a whole range of topics that are historically, I think, totally different.
Let me defend myself here. I think this is relevant for anybody going into politics. Now, do you know what aspect of your life is going to be open to investigation, well, either from a prosecutor or from the press? Is that line?
First of all, from the press standpoint, nothing is sacred. Nothing ever has been sacred, and the press has often had a pattern of going out and writing virtually whatever they want to. And that's been true for all of American history. But, you know, what Judge Starr has is a very different assignment. He has the question of whether or not there was perjury, which is a felony, whether or not there was obstruction of justice, which is a felony. And that's very different. It's one thing to say to somebody, are you perfect in your private life? My working assumption is none of us are, that we all need salvation based on faith rather than justice. But that there's a difference between saying all of us are imperfect and saying all of us commit felonies. And I think what we have to wait and see is, does Judge Starr report and say, here is proof that felonies were committed? Or does Judge Starr report and say, you know, I looked into everything. A lot of stuff here you may not like as a personal matter, but in my judgment, the law has not been broken. Now, that's a very clear and very vivid line, I think. And what we discovered with Richard Nixon was that the law had been broken. And that's a very powerful distinction as compared to, did Bill Clinton do things I may not personally approve of or things that lots of people do but nobody personally approves of?
In a March 16th column that you wrote for Insight magazine, you wrote, I would like Congress to pass a resolution that says national celebrities are and therefore should act like role models. And I wonder if you put politicians and, you know, congressmen into that national celebrity category who should act like role models.
Absolutely. And I think the topic of that particular column was drugs. And I was making the point that when you have somebody who makes a lot of money, as for example, endorsing Nike shoes or endorsing tennis rackets or endorsing things that young people really look up to, that those people ought to have a special burden because, after all, they're getting very rich in part because they are appealing to the young. And when that person shows up as a cocaine addict or a heroin addict or a crack addict, there's something very sad. And we shouldn't just say, well, gee, that's unfortunate, but, you know, we'll suspend them for 1 week and then come back next week. There really ought to be some kind of sanction. Part of what I suggested was that they should be required to turn in the drug dealer from whom they bought the illegal drugs as a price of getting back on the field or getting back on the court.
But do you think that role model should apply to somebody's private life, to the marital life, to infidelity?
Well, again, if you notice that the example I just cited, using illegal drugs mm-hmm. is illegal. It's not a private matter if you break a felony law. It's not a private matter if you're buying crack cocaine or heroin. That's a matter of illegality. And I'm trying to set a very, in a society that needs standards, I'm trying to set some very simple standards. Don't break major laws.
What about adultery?
Adultery is not, I don't think it's the same issue. The same thing with, there are a lot of things that I think you may not approve of personally, but you don't go to jail for them. And I think people have a right to make their own minds up about whether or not you want to condemn Bill Clinton or you want to condemn John F. Kennedy, or you can go back through history about people that we now know a lot more about than we used to. That's one level. Breaking the law is a different standard. And I think that we have every right as a society, particularly in America, which is bound together only by the law. I mean, we're not bound together racially. We're not bound together by nationality. We don't have any unique characteristic. We are Americans by virtue of having, we the people, having founded a constitution. And we are uniquely a nation under the law, unlike almost any other country in the world.
In your book, you write a little bit about having survived a near coup within your party, members of the House, Republican members of the House, who were trying to depose you and failed. What message did you take away from that?
Well, several things. First of all, as I recount in the book, it was probably the saddest moment for me because I had almost a sense of grief comparable to having a close relative die. I had worked very, very hard for my whole adult life to create a majority. I'd worked very closely with most of the members who were unhappy with me. I was very, very proud of the sophomore class that were the real class of 1994, by sophomores by the time you're talking about, who really had made such a huge difference in our history. And here I was, so out of touch with them and so lacking in ability to communicate and lead, that both some of the members of my leadership had lost their nerve and some of the freshmen, now sophomore class, had gotten so isolated and so upset that they thought that causing chaos and potentially ending my career was less expensive than trying to work things out. It was a very, very sad time. I flew home to Georgia and went out to dinner with my wife, Marianne, and my older daughter, Kathy. And we sat and talked, and I remember thinking at the time that I just had this very heavy heart and this sense of grief. I think in retrospect, and I try to cover this in Lessons Learned the Hard Way, I take a lot of responsibility for having failed to communicate clearly and a lot of responsibility for not having listened to their concerns and understood more sympathetically that even if they were sometimes wrong, that their intent was very sincere and they were very frustrated and very frightened. I mean, they had come to Washington to effect real change and they were very worried that we were selling out and compromising and losing our commitment and our desire and our momentum. And as I look back on that, I feel much greater sympathy for them than I did at the time.
What's it like to keep working with them?
Oh, it's fine now. I mean, it's a lot like a family where you have a very big, tough fight, and you go through a little counseling, and you learn to live with each other, and you gradually look back on that, and you say, that's one of the memories that made us who we now are. I mean, I think anybody who's had any long relationship will have occasionally had some kind of a fight in that relationship or some moment of disappointment in that relationship. And then you've got to decide, now, do I want to rebuild and keep that relationship moving forward, or has it shattered the relationship? And I think in these cases, virtually all of us have gotten back in the same room, worked with each other, and moved forward as a positive team.
My guest is Speaker of the House, Newt Gingrich. He's written a new book called Lessons Learned the Hard Way. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Newt Gingrich is my guest, and he's written a new book called Lessons Learned the Hard Way. Elizabeth Drew, formerly of The New Yorker, has written about you extensively, and one of the things she said is that both you and President Clinton have a lot in common. You're both from middle-class backgrounds, both from dysfunctional families, both had missing fathers, adoring mothers, and problematic relationships with adoptive fathers. She writes, both are exemplars of the meritocracy, both are garrulous, both had to show off, both had deep flaws and histories of infidelity. Do you think that you have this kind of connection with President Clinton, although you have very little in common politically? Do you feel that you have some kind of shared background and shared generational sense?
Well, I think we have a shared generational sense in that we both grew up in an America that was very different, say, than the America that George Bush or Walter Mondale or Bob Dole grew up in. I think in that sense, we're much more similar. He grew up in Arkansas. I grew up as an Army brat, born in Pennsylvania. I lived in Fort Riley, Kansas, Orléans, France, Stuttgart, Germany, and finally came to Fort Benning, Columbus, Georgia when I was a junior in high school. So in that sense, there are huge differences in our background. His stepfather was part of a business class in Hot Springs, which was a particular kind of town. My stepfather was a career soldier, an infantryman, which is a very different kind of background, honor duty country, the sense that wars are real and dangerous, the sense that the nation is in peril, I think was probably much more part of my life than it was in Hot Springs, Arkansas. On the other hand, we both love talking, and when we get together, we can chat for a long time, and we both like ideas. We share books with each other. You know, we're both sort of policy wonks. He is a broadly based liberal Democrat who would like to move his party towards the center. I'm a broadly based conservative Republican who is trying to redefine a center that's much more conservative. So there are some real similarities and there are some real differences. But, you know, certainly at a personal level, we find we have a lot to talk about and to share with each other that is interesting. And I think that does reflect our generation's efforts to deal with the information age, the world market, the rising differences in our culture. And I think that in that sense, Elizabeth Drew is probably broadly accurate.
What surprised you most about working with President Clinton?
I would say probably his toughness in trying to survive, the sheer resilience and energy he has in bouncing back time after time. And then I would say second, the fact that he constantly gets in trouble where he needs to survive. I mean, there's a point where you say, you know, it's great that you can survive. Have you ever considered trying to avoid these problems? Sometimes as you grow up and as you grow older, it's sort of nice to acquire the wisdom of maybe not touching the stove for the 1,100th time to prove to yourself it's hot.
Newt Gingrich is my guest, and he has a new book called Lessons Learned the Hard Way. I'd like to ask you about the Christian Coalition and their current power. The leadership of the Christian Coalition has complained that they haven't gotten enough from the Republican leadership in return for all the support that the coalition has given to electing Republican candidates in the past few years. Donald Hodel, the president of the coalition, told the Republican chairman that he was concerned that the party was being too accommodating on abortion. And he said that conservative Christians might break away from the Republicans and form their own party. And I think probably a few people think that that's about to happen, but it's been posed as a possibility. Do you think that there is a growing rift between the coalition and the Republican Party?
Well, no, I think that there is a natural tension in any majority party in America. And this is one of the reasons I wrote the book, because as we become a majority, we suddenly have these new problems. You know, when you're the minority party, you can kick out 10% of the minority, and it doesn't qualitatively change your experience. You were the minority before you kicked them out. You're the minority after they're kicked out. And so you can be much purer as a minority party. When you're the majority party, that 10% may be the margin of your majority. But if you're going to be a majority party in America, this is a great country filled with good people, but they sure are diverse.
It was recently reported that you met with Pat Robertson and Ralph Reed and agreed to follow through on certain aspects of the conservative Christian agenda. What do you feel like you recently had to pledge to get back their support?
I don't think we had to pledge anything we weren't already doing. We're already moving a religious liberties amendment through the Congress because we believe that the Supreme Court is profoundly wrong in its effort to drive God out of the public place. We think people should be allowed to pray, that they should not be persecuted by the government for engaging in religious liberties. We're already moving a bill on religious persecution overseas that Congressman Frank Wolf had authored. We have a bill on child abuse that we're going to move because it's been something we've been working on for the last 6 or 8 months. I would say overall, I'll give you an example. The partial birth abortion ban, which about 80% of all Americans agree with. I mean, very few Americans believe you should kill a baby in the last 2 or 3 months of its pregnancy. And particularly when they learn about the partial birth abortion technique, where the baby is partially born and then killed, there's overwhelming opposition to that technique. We were going to move the effort to override President Clinton's veto of that bill. We passed the bill last year, President Clinton vetoed it. But frankly, we're coordinating with the Right to Life groups, and we had an argument between some of the organizations who wanted us to move it quicker and some of the organizations who wanted more time to educate because they're trying to find 1 or 2 votes in the Senate that they don't have yet. So I think some of this is just a process of communication and trying to move things in a broad way in the right general direction.
Newt Gingrich, he's written a new book called Lessons Learned the Hard Way. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of the interview I recorded yesterday with Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich. He's written a new book called Lessons Learned the Hard Way. You've had the support of the Christian Coalition and have worked with them. One of the things the Christian Coalition is opposed to is homosexuality. Your sister, Candace, is a lesbian, and I'm wondering if her coming out has had any impact on your views of homosexuality.
You know, it's very fascinating. I have a sister, Susan, who's very active in the Christian Coalition, and a sister, Candace, who's very active in the Human Rights Organization, and a sister, Robbie, who sort of mediates. And when we get together, as you can imagine, we have a very individualistic family. And I would just say that I love Candace. She's my sister, and I respect how she has decided to live her life. And we're on opposite sides of the political spectrum about 2/3 of the time. But I think you can reach beyond politics when you talk about your own sister or your brother, or your mom and dad. And so we try to do that. We don't get into very many political arguments when we get home with my mother, who is also a very strong-willed individual. But as you can imagine, when you have all of us in the same room, it's a swirling opportunity if we wanted to get into some real political debates.
Well, I guess I'm wondering if you would like to see your sister protected by civil rights, equal rights legislation that would apply to homosexuality.
No, I don't understand. I frankly don't understand that concept. I think it's one thing to say about an objective external fact that you should not be discriminated against, but I don't think we need police in the bedroom. And my view is that that in fact we do not need, and it would be very confusing to have those kind of laws that apply to sexual behavior.
But the idea, I think, wouldn't be necessarily to put police in the bedroom, but rather to prevent a teacher from being fired if they were outed.
I think that the question is not, is a teacher fired if they're outed, but, for example, could you be a transvestite and be a second-grade teacher? And I think that there are community standards there that you could ask that are very legitimate.
Getting back to the Christian Coalition and homosexuality, I mean, I think the coalition stands for that homosexuality is morally wrong, should be discouraged, shouldn't be tolerated in certain positions. And I'm wondering if you agree with all of that, particularly because you are so close to somebody who is gay.
Well, let me say, first of all, the Bible is very clear about that as a concept. So, I mean, if you believe the Bible has a very straightforward position about it. But again, the Bible also says
in the Bible?
There are strong references in the Bible to homosexuality.
What are you referring to specifically?
Well, I'll let you go read the Bible and pull them up. I don't particularly want to get this again as a topic I don't spend a lot of time on. I don't want to get off and create a brand new controversy. But I would just suggest if you read the Bible, it's fairly explicit. But I think also that in my mind, it's not a public political issue. And it's not something that I think that is at the center of our society. And I think that it is certainly not something which ought to be involved in the center of national politics.
Newt Gingrich is my guest, and he's written a new book called Lessons Learned the Hard Way. One of your jobs, one of the things you have to do is sit in back of the president while he's making a State of the Union address. And so you're on camera just about the whole time.
Yes,
facing the camera.
It's very awkward.
Yes, I would imagine it's incredibly awkward. So I would just love to hear what goes through your mind when you're sitting there. Are you trying to be expressive or trying to show no expression of approval or disapproval? How awkward is all of that?
First of all, you try to show support for the things you believe in. When the president indicated we'd be discussing Social Security this year, it was a topic he and I had already been discussing for 2 months. I stood on my feet. I gave him a lot of support because I think it is very important for us to solve Social Security before the baby boomers get any older. On the other hand, when he stands for things I don't agree with him on, I try to be very disciplined and just sit there quietly and let Al Gore jump up and applaud without me. And it's kind of fun. Every once in a while, he'll say something which I think is so wrong, I'm half tempted to get up and disagree with him. But since I'm the host, I show great discipline and don't intervene. But in particular, for a couple of the State of the Unions, he had this totally false comment that we know the Russian missiles aren't targeted at the U.S. Now, in fact, it's totally false. I've talked to the CIA and I've talked to the Defense Intelligence Agency. Nobody knows where the Russian missiles are targeted. And the targeting is all done by a computer inside the missile. And it takes less than 2 minutes to retarget them. So it is a misleading statement that says, why don't we all relax because we're safe, which I think is a terribly dangerous thing for a president of a democracy to say. But, you know, when he says it, I just kind of grin and bear it and don't, you know, I try not to overtly express hostility because he is our guest. I am his host. And we have a real obligation as a country to be unified during the State of the Union. I feel very strongly that the President of the United States, as an institutional figure, deserves the respect and the support of the entire nation because we only have one country to display to the world. The whole world watches the State of the Union, and they should see a strong, unified America, even if it is to our partisan disadvantage sometimes.
One last question. When you became Speaker of the House, you said that you may have a limited success in terms of bills, but the whole language of politics is going to be transformed. Do you feel that you've been effective in transforming the language of politics?
I would say about 50-50. If you look at welfare, today people expect people to go to work or study. If you look at balanced budget, today people expect budgets to be balanced. We're beginning to go down the road on saving Social Security in a way that will change the language there. On the other hand, there are a lot of other things we've not been able to get through or get done yet that will take longer than I would have liked. And so I'd probably give us a 50-50 on that one.
Well, Newt Gingrich, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Newt Gingrich has written a new book called Lessons Learned the Hard Way.